everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on war when we come back. You know, in real estate transactions, we follow these three rules. It's called location, location, and location. Well, in criminal law, we follow three rules also when we're talking to the police or government agents, and that is, you don't say anything, you keep your mouth shut, and then shut up. Knowing what to say and when to say it and what not to say and who not to say it to is summed up in this maxim of law, and that is that all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. And that's why judges, in their opinions, make short, terse statements like these. Now listen to this first judge. He said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" And he said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. You know, if I said something like that, I'd be accused of being a tax protester or something, wouldn't I? Well, listen to the second judge. He said, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." And he said that in Belknap versus U.S. If I said something like that, I'd be accused of obstructing justice. So listen to this third judge. Here's what he had to say. He said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted." And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's educational. It's entertaining. It's informative. Best of all, it's free. The number to call again, 417-273-4967. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about this thing of war. From the perspective of the Bible, from the perspective of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, trying to discount these gods like Allah, Baal, George Bush, the United States, Great Britain, and Australia, the various gods around the world that all of us humans like to worship and follow and emulate. I pointed out, I said, you know, you Muslims ought to thank God every day, your God, I guess, Allah, that the God of Abraham isn't masterminding that war from the White House or from Tel Aviv, because if he were, and if we followed his modus operandi, and his plain statements that I'm the same yesterday, today, and forever, and I change not, then he would be following the same war plan that he followed against the Egyptians and against the Canaanites and the Hivites and Perizzites. And that policy was total annihilation. Today we call that genocide. Genocide. And so I just added in the words, well, this God evidently is a genocidal maniac because he practices genocide. But I showed you a couple of points. I said, after the genocide is over, we have peace in the land because there aren't any enemies. You know, if the Israelis, just picture this now, all you Israelis, you go in there and you kill every living thing 18 miles north of the border with Lebanon. Let me ask you this. How many rockets are going to be launched from that 18-mile piece of real estate? I think it'll drop to zero. But you see, you're not going to do that. What you're going to do is you're going to participate in a ceasefire, and you're going to make a contract or a covenant with your enemies, which the God of Abraham says he doesn't do and instructed us not to do. And then the ceasefire, which means time out to rearm. That's what a ceasefire is. It's time out to rearm. And then in 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years, just like happened the last time, the Hezbollah guys will be fully armed again, and then they'll engineer a provocation, and then they'll launch their rockets or their new attacks. And you will have perpetual war for perpetual peace. That's the game plan. It's perpetual war for perpetual peace, and as I pointed out, that's because there's money in war, but there's no money in peace. So you can't make any profits off of peace, but you make a lot of profit off of war. So that's why we have a lot of war. Now, war requires weapons, and these weapons require technology. Technology requires science. And if there's one thing that modern man really, really likes, worships, adores, and just gets really excited about, it's science. And every night on the 6 o'clock news, there's medical science. And then there's the Nobel Prizes, which go for science. And we're just immersed in science. We go to school to learn science. Science is everywhere. Science is the God of modern man. Science is what we all look to for answers to those questions that we have that we don't have answers for. Now, there's only two ways for you to learn. It's either you've got to experiment, as my old daddy used to say. He said, you know, son, there's just no substitute for experience. He says, experience is the best teacher. But he said, experience is a god-awful hard way to learn. And then he followed that up and he said, son, the next time you get ready to do something, you come and tell me what it is that you're getting ready to do. And then I will tell you from my experience, through revelation, what the outcome of that experiment is going to be. And then you can carry out that experiment, and you can learn by experience, or you can listen to my revelation, and you can learn from my experience. Well, what does a 13-year-old kid do? He's not going to listen to some old man, you know, who's 30 years old or 35 or something like that. He's going to go out and try it for himself, you know. You don't come to your dad and say, well, gee, I want to smoke a cigarette. Dad, what's the outcome going to be? Gee, Dad, I want to go out and drink a six-pack of beer. What's the outcome of that going to be? I want to drink and drive. I want to go have some premarital sex. What's the outcome of all this going to be? You know, when you're a teenager, you don't want to go tell your old man, you know, hey, listen, I'm about to lay the neighbor girl. So we don't go to revelation. It's just something that is it's just not part and parcel with human anatomy. Revelation is something that we shun. It's something that we want to avoid, like AIDS, herpes, and VD. But experimentation, now that's something else again. We want to experiment with sex. We want to experiment with alcohol. We want to experiment with fast cars or slow cars. You know, when you get started, you know, I started out in a 32 or 33 Chevrolet. It wasn't a fast car, but it was a car. And so I started off with a slow car, and then I moved up to fast cars. And so pretty soon you want fast cars and fast women and fast airplanes. That's just the way, and you want to experiment. See? Now, sometimes the experiments go bad. And science is experimentation. There's just no other way around it. You have to experiment. You know, if you want to break the sound barrier, you got to get into an airplane, take it up real high, and aim it down toward the ground, see how fast you can go. And with the aid of gravity, you know, and a fast airplane, you can take an airplane and go pretty fast going straight down. Of course, sometimes the wings come off or the tail section comes off, but, you know, it's that experimentation. Now, a few people have to get killed in the process, but then that's the price we pay for science, for knowledge. You know, if we want to learn, we have to experiment. Now, the very first experiment, the very first scientific experiment among mankind, recorded in history, was done in the Garden of Eden by our great-great-great-great-grandma Eve. She was the very first one to reject revelation and to embrace science. And it was a marvelous success. Marvelous success. The world's first scientific experiment was conducted in the Garden of Eden, and it was a remarkable success. And the story is recorded in Genesis 3, verses 1 through 24. Experimentation over revelation is shown clearly, and I think that you're lying to me, is what Eve said about God. He said, I think you're lying, so I'm going to try it and prove you wrong. So there were these two trees in the garden. One was called the tree of life and the other called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God came along and he says, okay, let me give you some wise old counsel here. Over here is this real neat tree, and I want you to eat off of this tree. This tree is full of vitamins and minerals and amino acids. And then it's going to give you eternal life. It's going to give you everything you want and ought to have, and it's what I want you to eat. And over here, I've got a second tree. This tree over here is nutritionally deficient. And it's called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then he said, you don't want to know about evil, and I'll just tell you about good. So you listen to Revelation. Forget about experimentation. Lay off this tree. Don't eat off of this. And he walks out of the garden. And so, you know, pretty soon Satan came in. He said, hey, listen, lady. Hey, lady. Did God tell you that you ought not to eat off this tree? And she said, yep. And so he said, well, you know, God's lying to you. He reinforced her innate suspicion that God was trying to keep away from her something that was really good. Children are that way. They always view their parents as people who are trying to spoil kids' fun. Parents are the people, no, don't do that. Come over here. Stand still. Don't you jump in that water. Don't you do this. Don't you, just constantly, isn't it? I mean, parents are just there to spoil kids' fun. And then, of course, the kid, you know, he's always looking around so he can find mom and dad when they're not looking so he can go out and experiment. He wants to jump in that mud puddle. Or he wants to go strike that match. Or he wants to go do something over here, you know, so he can learn. He wants to find out. He's got a natural curiosity. He wants to learn. And so Eve, you know, she had this natural curiosity about that tree. And she said, well, you know, he told me not to eat off that tree. Now, I just wonder why. It's good-looking fruit, and it looks like it's good to eat. And then here comes a guy along here, and he says, that is good to eat. And besides that, your eyes will be opened, and you'll be like God. You'll be smart like he is. You want to get real smart? Science is the way to go. So she ate off the tree. She conducted the experiment. Now, the Revelation, said, in the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die. Now, in that day, we'll call it June 14th, year 9, or whatever year it was, June 14th, year 9, she eats off the tree. Now, for 9 years, she's been walking around in the garden over here eating off of the tree of life, and now all of a sudden she eats off of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and she does not die. And she has proven God wrong. You know, in her mind, she said, he said, in the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die. Now, that phrase, in the day that you eat thereof, you will surely die, can be taken two ways. It has two meanings. Did God mean that the day, June 14th, that you eat off that tree, you will die before sundown? Or did he mean, in the day that you eat off of that tree, it will ultimately, at some point in time, not on June 14th, but at some point in time, lead to death? Now, Eve's dead. Best as I can figure out, she died. The scripture says she died. It says Adam died. It says everybody that sins died. It says the wages of sin is death. And I haven't heard anybody come around claiming to be Eve, saying, no, God's wrong again, I've got eternal life. And I've been here for 6,000 years, incognito, living in Paris. So the way the phrase was enunciated to her, she, on that day, June 14th, came to the conclusion, well, God was a liar, and I ate off the tree and I didn't die. So her success in that first experimentation was total. Now, ultimately, she paid with her life because she ultimately did die. I don't know if she lived to be 6, 7, 800, 900 years older. Her husband lived to be 930. Doesn't say how old she was when she died. 930. I would presume she was old and full of years. Now, there's our first experiment. And hey, listen, nothing's changed. You and I are experimenters, and we like to do that. Now, science is real smart. They, the scientists, have given us automatic garage door openers so that we don't have to get out of our cars to open the garage door on a stormy night and then get our feet wet, which wet feet cause cold, and then which colds turn to pneumonia, and then when we get pneumonia, we die. So science has taught us that wet feet causes pneumonia. And then if that were true, we would all have pneumonia every time we get in the bathtub or every time we took a shower. Now, how many times have you blamed a cold or the flu on wet feet? Or you've heard somebody else say, well, you got your feet wet. And they call that science. I call that preposterous poppycock. That's like Santa Claus coming down a 6-inch flu, you know, into my oil heater, you know, which is on 24/7. And that's what they were teaching me when I was a little kid. But, you know, that doesn't make any sense. But I've had doctors tell me that wet feet cause colds, flu, and pneumonia. Doctors? Well, you must have got your feet wet. My Aunt Bessie was a nurse, and she always blamed colds and flu on wet feet. Well, science is real smart. They've given us lasers that will melt the flesh off of a person at 100 yards. That's just the kind of invention that we all want, and the kind of invention that we all need, isn't it? But then, when was the last time you had a need to melt the flesh off of someone at 100 yards? You know, I'm an old man already, and I never have had a need to melt the flesh off of somebody's body or their bones standing off at 100 yards. And then, while it's a wonderful invention, and I'm sure that it was worth every dollar that we taxpayers paid to Lockheed Martin or to Sandia or whoever it was that invented that, or Alamogordo or the University of California at Berkeley or somebody, I'm sure that it was well worth the money. But, again, Joe Sixpack sitting out here saying, what in the hell does that do for me? I paid for it. Now we've got it. Wonderful technology, and I'm sure we can use it in the war on terror, but what does it do for a farmer in North Dakota? Now, science is real smart, and they've given us bows and arrows. Then they gave us catapults and gunpowder and guns and artillery and fighter jets and B-52 bombers and atom bombs. But how have these marvelous inventions improved our standard of living? How have these weapons increased our lifespan or cured our diseases? I don't deny that a B-52 is a marvelous invention. I'm sitting here in awe every time I see one of them go over, and I think, wow, look at that. I watch the old pictures of the carpet bombers, you know, going over Vietnam, and I say, my God, look at that. I look at a 747, I say, God, what marvelous technology, what a marvelous invention that's been. But again, these inventions of war don't improve the lives of the average Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives. Now, do they? Now, science is real smart. God asked Job 40 scientific questions about 1600 B.C. You'll see this in Job chapter 38. He comes up to Job. He's a little ticked off at it. And he says, hey, you, big mouth, come over here, sit down and listen up. I'm going to ask you some questions over here. And if you know so damn much, answer me. Answer me. I had my dad do that to me a couple of times. You ever had your mom or dad say, answer me, you know? Just really ticked off at you. Well, Job listened to these 40 questions. He couldn't answer a single one of those questions. Not one. God asked him 40 things. Now, scientific questions. You know, like, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Just ask yourself that. Where were you when God laid the foundations of the earth? Got an answer for that? Do you know where you were? Well, all of you Christians out there who have immortal souls, can't you remember back when you were in heaven with God or Jesus or somebody? I don't know. We have these religious guys and philosophers, you know. The truth of the matter is, I haven't got a clue as to where I was when God laid the foundations of the earth. I don't know when he laid the foundations of the earth. I don't know what the foundations of the earth are. I don't know what the cornerstone of the earth's foundation is, you know. And hell, I'm an old man, been around for a long time and been reading a lot of science. I don't know the answer to that. But Job admitted he didn't know the answer to it. And today, 3,600 years after Job admitted to God that he couldn't answer a single one of those 40 questions, our science today can answer 3 out of those 40. 3! That's not bad. And at that rate, we will be able to answer God with all 40 answers in 47,999 years. 47,999 years. We'll be able to answer all 40 of those questions at that rate, 3 every 3,600 years. So isn't science just real marvelous? Now remember, we're talking about science versus revelation. Now God comes along in the scripture and he says, well, now I'm a revelator. I give out revelation. There's a book in the Bible called Revelation, written by this same guy. And he entitled it the Book of Revelation. It's not the book of science. It's not the book of experimentation. It's not the book of hypotheses and theories. It's a book called Revelation, where this guy walks in and he says, here's what I'm going to do. I've got the power to do it. Here's about when I'm going to do it, and here's what I'm going to do, and here's what it's going to look like when I'm doing it. Now, that's called revelation. We reject revelation because we don't like God, and we want to reject God, and we reject his revelation, just like we reject mom and dad, and we reject their revelations in favor of experimentation, theory, hypotheses, and science. But science is real smart. And science says that we don't know what causes cancer, and we cannot cure cancer either. But for $100,000, we can treat cancer. And if you don't die in 5 years, we call that a cancer cure. Now, if we treat you for cancer, the average lifespan after we begin treatment is 18 months. But if you should elect not to treat your cancer, your average lifespan will be 6 years. If you aggressively treat your cancer, on average, it will cost you $100,000 to die in 18 months. If you leave that cancer alone, you can save the $100,000 and live 4.5 years longer and leave the $100,000 to your wife or children. And I say again, isn't science marvelous? Now, we spend $500 billion a year in this country. This is the United States of America. $500 billion a year. That's a half a trillion dollars a year on cancer. Cancer. President Nixon, back in 1971 or two, said, we're going to declare war on cancer. And so he did. He got up in front of Congress in the State of the Union. He said, I declare war on cancer! You know, or words to that effect. And then he appropriated $2 billion to cancer research. And we've been doing that ever since. It's more than $2 billion a year now. What that amounted to was WPA for PhDs. That's what that boils down to. It's WPA for PhDs. Puts all these college professors and science departments and all these people to work, keeps them off the streets, out of the unemployment lines, out of the pool holes, and then out of trouble. Looking for a cure to cancer. Now, that was 1972. They haven't found a cure to cancer. I'm going to make a prediction. They're not going to find a cure to cancer. Cancer is a $500 billion a year business, and the minute we find a cure to cancer, it ends our $500 billion a year gravy train, and especially the war on cancer, federal tax dollars that goes to the PhDs and the universities to pay all the people to look for a cure to cancer. But every night on the 6 o'clock news, there's an update and a report on cancer research. I always have a report on cancer research and what's going on with stem cells and so on. So I said, well, my God, isn't science wonderful? Now, science is real smart. You know, science is the opposite to revelation. And thanks to science, we now know why the rivers run into the sea and the sea is not full. We call it meteorology. Now, God only knows how much time, effort, money, and energy that we mortals have expended in our quest for the answer to this riddle or this question. Which, it's called the hydrologic cycle, and it's revealed in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7. Now, with science, we have now figured out what Solomon had revealed to him on the subject of meteorology 3,000 years ago. So again, let's hear it for science. Let's hear it for science. You know, science is real smart, and I expect science to put an end to war, like science has put an end to cancer, heart attack, stroke, diabetes, famine, plague, and death, which, by the way, science has been promising for as long as I can remember. Science has been promising us an end to cancer, heart attack, stroke, diabetes, famine, plague, and death for all of my life. So I say to you, boys and girls, just be patient and just be very generous with your financial support as you support the God of science. Well, science is real smart, and science is our new God. Science is the God of this world, and not without good reason. You know, science has given us the automobile, the airplane, electricity, steel ships that float on water. They've given us air conditioning, computers. They've given us a multitude of gadgets, toys, and amusements to entertain us and to work for us and to give us pleasure. But our God, science, is unable to give us health, happiness, eternal life, rain in due season, prevent birth defects, cure cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's disease, or bring us peace. Science cannot bring us peace. And so far, all we've gotten from science is more war and bigger, nastier, bloodier, scarier wars. Now, there was a time when war was chivalrous. When armies met on the battlefield and knights duked it out in support of or for the honor of their kings or their queens. And as time progressed, we developed big armies. Armies of conscripts. Not just knights fighting knights, but now civilians conscripted into armies, armed by the king and sent into battle. We had the redcoats against the bluecoats. And we went out there and we fought and we duked it out, and the last man standing on the battlefield, I guess, was the winner. And then we had war and we had victories, and it was bloodier and more costly. And then as time went on, we got to the point where in World War II, we could firebomb a city like Dresden and kill 100,000 people, men, women, and children. Now, boys and girls, last time we were talking about a genocidal God over here that killed all the people in Jericho. And he's wicked and evil and bloody and something to be reviled, avoided. But somehow, when America and Great Britain bomb a city in Germany and kill 100,000 people, that seems to be just the fruits of war, isn't it? When America dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and God knows those two cities needed to be nuked, killed about, 70,000-80,000 people in each one of those cities, destroyed those cities. I want you to remember that those weapons of mass destruction were implemented and utilized by gum-chewing, camera-toting Americans, soccer moms, Joe Sixpack, not by Adolf Hitler or Tojo or Saddam Hussein or Kim Il-sung, some dictatorial tyrant from North Korea or China or a Chow En Lai or a Mao Zedong. I'm talking about Harry Truman. I'm talking about Americans. Gum-chewing, camera-toting Americans. Now, boys and girls, if Joe Sixpack and Sally Soccer Mom can drop a nuclear weapon on their enemies in Japan, do you think that it's a stretch of your imagination that some raghead over in Afghanistan, if he could get hold of one of those nuclear weapons, would use it in Chicago, New York, London, or Paris? That doesn't stretch my imagination too far. Not at all. And then there's another little thought that I thought I'd throw into the mix over here. You know that Kim Il-sung guy up there in North Korea? I mean, you know, all about 4'11" of him. He suffers from the little man syndrome. He has this great big pompadour hairstyle. He probably wears 3-inch platform shoes to get him up to 4'11". And he's a little guy. And you got to watch out for little guys because they get what we call the little man syndrome, and they need to show that they're big men. That's why little guys like to take on big guys. Because if they can whip them, then they're a big guy in their eyes. See, and they get to be one of the big boys. Well, anyway, this Kim Il-sung up here now, he's discovered nuclear weapons, and he says he's got 3 or 4 of them. Do you, honest to God, believe that the Al-Qaeda guys don't know that the North Koreans have the bomb? And have you thought about maybe the Al-Qaeda guys went over and talked to the North Koreans and said, hey, listen, we got money over here. We get it from American oil passed off to the Saudi Arabian government, who in turn gives that money to us so that we can come to you and we can buy one of these nuclear weapons so that we can use it against one of those American cities. Do you think maybe the North Koreans have thought of that? Do you think maybe Al-Qaeda has thought of that? Boys and girls, if the Al-Qaeda guys don't already have a nuclear weapon, that they're not working very hard. Now, these Iranians over here, you know, they were named along with the North Koreans as the Axis of Evil. I don't think the Iranians are very sympathetic toward America or American interests, and I don't think the North Koreans are either. Don't you think that maybe the North Koreans have talked to the Iranians kind of through the back door and said, hey, can we help you in some way? We got a common enemy, America. Have you thought about that? Now remember, our God, the Revelator, has told us the way of peace. You people don't know. You haven't got a clue. You can't figure that out. And you don't have to be real smart. You don't have to go to college. You don't have to have letters after your name to go pick up some history books and look back and just point to peace, would you? Point to peace in the 20th century. I don't think that in the 20th century there was a single year in which there wasn't a war going somewhere. If there was, I don't know. Now, let me tell you another little unsettling fact over here. The Pakistanis, it costs a lot of money to build a nuclear weapon. Now, Iran could build one because they've got a lot of money. The Pakistanis are as poor as church mice, and they build a nuclear weapon. And it led a lot of us to ask the question, where did the Pakistanis get the money to build that? And the answer is they got it from the Saudi Arabians. And the Saudis, Muslims that they are, finance the Pakistanis, Muslims that they are, against the Hindus, their enemies to the south, and the Pakistanis developed a nuclear weapon. Do you think maybe that the Saudi Arabians got a payoff? Well, I picked up an article the other day from the International Forecaster, and Robert Chapman had a little piece in there, and he said the Saudis have a location, and he identified the location. Didn't mean anything to me, but he said they've got a bunch of nuclear weapons stockpiled in Saudi Arabia. Isn't that just real special? And where'd they get them? That was the payoff. They got them from the Pakistanis. And why did the Saudis need the nukes? Well, they needed them because the Israelis have got them. The Israelis have got them. Where'd the Israelis get them? Well, they got them from the Americans. They used their spies over here, and they stole the secrets and went back and built their own bomb. Now, children, let's be realistic here if we can. You got the North Koreans with the bomb. And you got the Pakistanis with the bomb, you got the Saudis with the bomb, the Israelis with the bomb, and then you got God, who's about to stage the biggest war that we've ever seen in Israel, in the Valley of Megiddo, called the Battle of Armed Megiddo, or Armageddon. And you've got 3 wars going on simultaneously here in the Middle East, which sits on top of the world's biggest reserves of oil that everybody in the world needs and wants, and America's got, and everybody else wants to take it away from us. Now, what do you think that's going to lead to? Peace in our time? Or war? Well, while you're mulling that over, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.com. georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. And remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. I may give you a reminder that I've had a number of inquiries about conducting a tax and status school in Austin, Texas. So if you're one of those that's called, or if you haven't, but you might be interested in a personal live tax and status school in your hometown, Austin, Texas, or the environs thereof, why don't you call us here at the law school for the date and time, probably in September or October. I haven't set the date positively yet. Number to call again, 417-273-4967. Just ask for Jackie or Cole. 417-273-4967, and they will give you the information. All right, we're talking about war. War, very, very timely topic. We've got three wars going on now in the Middle East. Three wars, just precursors. Remember in Matthew 24, the disciples asked the Messiah, they said, well, tell us what's going to be the sign of your coming. And he said, well, there'll be wars and rumors of wars. And he said, see that you be not troubled. So don't be troubled over these three wars in the Middle East. The shoe has not fallen yet. It's going to fall. But it has not fallen just yet. Now, I got a letter here, and I wanted to share this letter with you because it comes from a lady named Deborah. And it's over taxes, but what she said in here, I think, is very poignant in the subject matter of war. So listen to the letter, and then I'm going to answer the questions. She's got three questions here. And then it's the statement that she made about her choices that she has available to her that I thought was so poignant. She said, I just finished listening to your radio archive show on tithe versus income tax, and I enjoyed it very much. However, I'm confused about a few things, and the first and most pressing issue is the statement that you made that paying income tax was serving Baal. Now, I do not see that from the scriptures. I read 1 Samuel 8 with emphasis on verses 15 and 17. However, it does not say you will be serving Baal, nor did it say the king would cause them to sin. Israel did have a few kings that were men of God, for example, David. How would they be serving Baal because the king took a tenth of their stuff? I can certainly see where the king might be sinning, because to me that would be stealing. Therefore, I do not think the income tax is stealing. But I'm not clear as to how I'm sinning, as I really have no choice but to pay the income tax if I want to function in this society. She goes on to say, the other question I have is with respect to the multiple tithes. And I understand the first tithe goes to God, the Levites. The second tithe is for the holy days, vacation money. And that there's a third tithe every 3 years for the poor and widows and orphans. How are the tithes calculated? For example, if you make $100, a tenth is $10, which is the first tithe. Is the second tithe then a tenth of $90, or is it $10 as well? Is the third tithe a tenth of $89, or is it $10 also? With respect to the giving of the tithe, since we don't know where the Levites are, am I to understand correctly that we give the first and third tithe to the poor, widows and orphans? All right. She says, thank you for answering my questions. I got to apologize, Deborah. This letter is dated March 12, 2006. We're already into August, and I didn't answer it. Evidently, it just got on my desk. I don't know what happened to it. It must have been sitting around here in a pile somewhere. Normally, I answer these questions earlier than this. I mean, I don't wait 5 or 6 months to answer your question. But since it's a question of general interest, let's answer this tithe question, and then let's answer the question as I really have no choice. Let me start from the bottom. With respect to the giving of the tithe, since we don't know where the Levites are, am I understanding correctly that we give the first and third tithe to the poor, widows, and orphans? The answer is yes. You give it to the poor, widows, and orphans because the other choice that you have is you give it to the Catholic Church or Oral Roberts or Jerry Falwell. Well, unless you want to give it to the United States government or somebody else. The tithe only goes to Levites, but the Levites are nowhere to be found. And if they are, I don't know where they're at. But the Levites had a duty, and they gave the tithe. In the case where they needed it for widows, orphans, and the poor, they gave it to the widows, orphans, and the poor. So since I don't have a Levite to give it to, that's where I send mine. Widows, orphans, and the poor. She said, the other question I have is with respect to the multiple tithes, and understand the first tithe goes to God, the Levites, second tithe for the holy days, vacation money, and there's the third tithe every 3 years for the poor and so on. How are these tithes calculated? For example, if you make $100, a tenth is $10, which is the first tithe. Is the second tithe then a tenth of $90? Yes, $9. And is the third tithe then a tithe of $89? And the answer is yes. It's a tithe of $89, which is $8. Excuse me. Tithe on $89, which would be $8.90. So that's the way that comes down. Now, just for simplicity's sake, I round mine off and pay 10, 10, and 10. And it costs me $1.90 more to do that, $1.90 more. But by doing that, I give God a little bit more, which fulfills another statute here. I'll cite it for you. It's in Malachi 3, verse 8. Malachi 3, verse 8. In which he says, will a man rob God, yet you've robbed me, but you say, wherein have we robbed you? And he says, in tithes and offerings. Notice the word offerings down there. There are also 7 annual holy days, and you're not to come before the eternal empty. So every time you come into a holy day, like Passover, the days of unleavened bread, there's 2 holy days. Feast of Weeks, 1 holy day. Day of Atonement, Feast of Trumpets, Feast of Tabernacles, and Last Great Day. Every time you come to those holy days, you should have a holy day offering. I don't know if it should be $50 or $100 or whatever, but you should always have an offering. So you've got tithes and offerings. So I like to round mine off so that I give a little bit more. I've got a business partner here, and I want to make sure that my business partner gets a little bit more than we agreed to. He wanted 10%, I give him 10%, and I round it off. Now, you made this statement, Deborah, in the last sentence of the first paragraph, and you said, how would they be serving Baal because the king took a tenth of their stuff? I can certainly see where the king would be sinning, because to me that would be stealing. Therefore, I do not think that the income tax is stealing, but I'm not clear as to how I'm sinning, as I really have no choice but to pay the income tax if I want to function in this society. And I wanted to zero in on if I want to function in this society, and my question to you is, why do you want to function in this society? In view of the fact that in Revelation 18:4, God himself said that you're to come out of her, my people, I don't know whose people you are, Deborah, so I'm not going to be judgmental. But in Revelation 18:4, listen to this. He says, I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues. Now, their sins and their plagues, the plague is the result of sin. It's the punishment or the penalty that you get for the sin. Are you really sure that you want to throw your lot in with the United States of America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, France, England, Germany, or Spain, and suffer the plagues that are coming down on this world during the Great Tribulation? I don't know. For my part, I don't want to. So I'm going to opt out. That's my conclusion. So I'm not really sure that you want to be a part and a function in this society. But you said, I really don't have any choice but to pay the income tax. Oh, no, no, you've got a choice. You get a choice. You don't have to have income. There's no tax on property. You have income. You work at JCPenney or you work at Sears or some corporation out here because that's your choice. That's what you wanted to do. Not because you had to. Nobody stuck a gun to your head and said you're going to work here at Sears or Walmart. So you've got a choice. The choice may be inconvenient, and I think that's basically what the problem is. That if I don't have a credit card, if I don't have a checking account, if I don't do business like everybody else and use Federal Reserve notes, unjust weights and balances, if I don't have a mortgage on my house, you know, like everyone else, you know, I would be different. I would stand out. I would be a peculiar people, which, by the way, God uses that term several times in the Scripture, calling people who do not participate in the general society around us as peculiar people. You know, a guy without a social security number, marriage license, driver's license, doesn't pay the income tax, deals in gold and silver, doesn't deal in Federal Reserve notes, doesn't have a mortgage on his house, is free and clear and debt-free. Deborah, that's a peculiar person, wouldn't you agree? And yet, those laws are what God mandates in opposition to unjust weights and balances, which is a violation of Leviticus 19:35 and 36 and so on. Now, in 1 Samuel 8, verses 15 and 17, is the penalty that we pay for our idolatry. Worship is obedience to your master or your God, and the tax is upon dollars, which are unjust weights and measures. And no man can serve two masters. Now, in Matthew 6:24, this is sweet Jesus, remember. And he said, no man can serve two masters because he'll hold to the one and hate the other. So am I to presume then, Deborah, that what you're suggesting is that you pay your tithe and your income tax so that you can serve the United States of America and God? Which God himself said, you can't do that. Now maybe you want to prove him wrong. You know, you can do that. Mormons do. Mormons pay their tithes to the church and their tax to the state. They can spread their legs, straddle the fence, and keep both ears to the ground at the same time. That's quite a trick. Now, you owe the income tax if you have income, and you owe the tithe if you have property, but you don't owe both. You owe one God the income tax, you owe the other God the tithe. And the Creator God says, forget the income tax and income and you practice my law. And of course, the state comes along and they induce you, just like Satan did to Eve. He said, now listen, has God told you that you ought to use gold and silver? Hey, listen, he knows that if you use Federal Reserve notes that you're going to make a lot of profit and gain and that you're going to have a retirement benefit and Social Security, and he's trying to spoil your fun. That's what the state's telling you. And then, of course, you're asking the question, well, now, I really don't have any choice. Well, I disagree. Or as they say in law, I dissent from that opinion. I live here in the United States of America, and I'm in my office, and I've got electric lights here. I've got indoor plumbing, believe it or not. And I avoid income like AIDS, herpes, and VD. I don't have to have income, and I've elected not to have it, and I deal in property. That's why here at the law school, we charge our tuition in gold coin. Pursuant to Title 31 of the U.S. Code and pursuant to Leviticus 19, 35, and 36, and Deuteronomy 25, 13 through 16. You have to learn how to practice the law of God and the law of Moses, along with the law of the United States and the law of your state, and probably with your county and your city ordinance as well, and do it all at the same time. And we do that under the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause and Public Law 97-280, which is at Statute 96-1211. So we have the First Amendment, and then we have Public Law 97-280, and then we have Seeger versus U.S. We have Acts 5:29. Now, all of these authorities are in agreement that the Scripture takes priority over the laws of your city, county, state, and national government. Believe it or not, they all agree. Now, the choice that you have is, do I want to be inconvenienced by practicing the law of Moses, or do I want to practice convenience at the drive-up window at the bank? And do I want to have the accolades and the adoration of my fellow man around me, or do I want to stand out being an iconoclast or a peculiar person who doesn't practice the everyday garden variety laws of the state? Now, those are the choices that you have. All right, so I've answered that question. Now, as we apply this to war, you know, Americans, and I imagine, you know, people in general around the world, they don't want to stand out and be obnoxious jerks. They want to be looked up to, and they want to be revered. They want people's adulation. They want people's respect. So young men go out and join the army. And these brave young men and women go to Iraq to be killed and maimed and injured to fight to make the world safe for what? I'm not sure that President Bush knows what the hell we're doing in Iraq. First of all, we went over there, remember, because this guy Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. We got over there and there are no weapons of mass destruction, which is what Hans Blix, the UN arms inspector, reported before the war began. He said there's no weapons of mass destruction. If there are, we haven't been able to find them. All right, so then, well, we're over here then for regime change. Okay, well, now we've changed the regime. Now what are we there for? Well, we're here to build democracy. Okay, so we help these guys with some elections over there. And so now we're over there building democracy. Okay, well, now what are we there for? Well, we've got this sectarian violence over here, and we're here now to maintain stability. So now you've got Shiites and Sunnis killing each other at the rate of about 100 a day. 50 a day, anyway. And then you've got your commanding general over there says, Jesus, we're on our way to descending into civil war. Okay, well, now what are we there for? There aren't any weapons of mass destruction. We've accomplished regime change. And now they've got a democratic government and a civil war. Well, now what else do you want to do? I'm not opposed to the war in Iraq. I'm not for it, but I'm not opposed to it. But there's a cause for the war. And the cause for that war is sin. We Americans have been violating the law of God. And one of the penalties that comes down on us for that is war. War is the penalty. It's not the only penalty. It is a penalty among many that come upon us for violating the law. So, you know, again, if war is what you want and it's the logical thing to do and I'm behind my country 100%, or as one famous presidential candidate said, I back Eagleton 1,000%. Well, Senator Mitchell, you know, when he was running for president. And he says, I'm going to back my vice presidential candidate 1,000%. Well, that's until tomorrow or the next day when we're going to dump him from the ticket. It's a liability. All right, so that's the way that game is played. That's politics. And this thing of war now is a result. It's a cause and effect event. You wring your nose, you get blood. You drive too fast around the corner, you run off the road and roll your car three times. There are certain laws that are in effect, and there's a cause and effect relationship that goes with it. You eat fat, you plug up your arteries. If you have a zinc deficiency, your offspring will have, what was that story the other day? There's a disease, scurvy, remember, comes from vitamin C deficiency, and that zinc deficiency was a chromosomal deficiency, and I've forgotten the name of it now, but mongoloid, that's a mongoloid disease, if that's a mongoloid syndrome, I guess they call it. Cause and effect relationship. Next time we'll take a look at that cause and effect relationship, and I'll show you from Ezekiel chapter 14 and 13. That cause and effect relationship. In fact, I guess I got a minute or two. I'll just start, I guess, with Ezekiel chapter 14. If you get a Bible there, why don't you flip over to Ezekiel 14? And there's a little story in there about Noah and Daniel. And then he says there in verse 12, he says, "The word of the Eternal came to me again, saying, Son of man, when the land sins against me by trespassing grievously, then will I stretch out my hand upon it, and I'll break the staff of the bread thereof, and I'll send famine upon it, and I'll cut off man and beast from it. And though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, says the Eternal." If George Gordon can save himself out of this, I'll be doing a big job, but I can't save you or anybody else. And God himself gives this example. He says, hey, listen, if Job, Noah, and Daniel were in the United States of America, they would only save themselves for their own righteousness. He says, if I cause a noisome beast to pass through the land and they spoil it so that it be desolate, and no man may pass through because of the beast, though these three men were in it, as I live, says the Eternal, they will deliver neither sons nor daughters. They only shall be delivered, but the land shall be desolate. Again, these three righteous prophets of old could only deliver themselves for their own righteousness. A lot of times people will say to me, well, dude, are you saying then that you can have life by works? And I just wanted to emphasize, yes, yes, you can. And Ezekiel 14 explains to you how. Now, if you want to go out here and practice abortion and adultery and you want to steal with Federal Reserve notes, get after it. But the wages of sin is death. Now, if you want to live a little longer, you know, until you're 70 or 75, then you need to practice the Ten Commandments and the 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. And if you don't, then you get peace taken away from you and you get war in its place. All right, we'll talk more about that next time on the Law Hour, an editorial review, talking about this thing of war and peace next time. Let me remind you, though, that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information about the homeschool program, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course, talking about war and peace. And so until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.